and welcome to another On The Hoof podcast. Now, this is a very unusual podcast, and I'm delighted to be joined by our very own SRUC Bee Advisor, Lorraine Johnston, who has been in post for 3 years. Hi, Lorraine.
Hi.
You, as I understand it, Lorraine, you've kept bees for over 10 years, and with your partner, you have over 60 hives. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
An amazing number of hives.
Very easy to become addicted to beekeeping and go from 2 to 60 in no time.
That's incredible. And I know that you have had a vast amount of experience teaching in schools about beekeeping and looking, organising bee health days and everything educational on honeybee health. So we have this podcast for anyone who's interested in honeybees. Shall I kick off with saying, you know, we've seen various accounts in the news about honeybees. Are honeybees actually endangered?
It's a common question I get asked, but in general, no. You know, a lot of people think, oh, you see the message, save the bees. And in actual fact, honeybees aren't endangered in the sense that, you know, we do have plenty of honeybees, managed honeybees in Scotland. There are approximately 3,099 registered beekeepers in Scotland. They're registered on something called BeeBase, which is really useful to be registered on because it gives you a wealth of information and highlights whenever there's disease in your area. But actually, there are many more beekeepers out there that aren't registered, and because it's not compulsory, it's just something that we do advise, though. And so, you know, we have plenty of honeybees. However, there are lots of issues that have a huge impact on the health of honeybees, and we will hopefully discuss those in future podcasts. There's one species of honeybee in the UK, which we call Apis mellifera, the European honeybee, and they're not endangered, although there's lots of threats to them, such as pests like varroa and various diseases, and climate change is having an impact as well. And we have the threat of pests such as the yellow-legged hornet coming in as well.
That's fascinating, Lorraine. So what are the common types of honeybees in Scotland?
There are various subspecies of honeybees in Scotland. Like mentioned, the European honeybee is the most common, but we can also get, over the years, we've had imports of Italian bees, Carleonian bees, and some people may have heard of Buckfast bees, but they're actually a mix of breeds. A lot of beekeepers have locally bred mongrel bees, which are really, they're the best ones to have in Scotland because they're best suited to our environment. And we would encourage beekeepers to breed from those rather than get imports from abroad that may not be as well suited to our environment. There are pockets of native black bees, which are called Apis mellifera, in more remote areas of Scotland. And these are our native bees. They're sometimes called black bees. And on the islands of Colonsay and Oronsay, it's a black bee reserve, so it's protected and you cannot take other bees to those islands. But the black, traditional black bee in Scotland is our native bee, and many people are fascinated by those sorts of bees. The only problem is if you're in a wide range where there's a mix of other subspecies of honeybees like Italian and Carniolan, they will mix. So it's difficult to get the, you know, original strain there.
That's really interesting, Lorraine. I had no idea there were so many species of honeybee. For our listeners, I mean, obviously we've seen hives, but what is a honeybee hive made up of?
So honeybees are managed bees, and in a typical hive in Scotland, you could have around 50,000 bees, 50,000 to 60,000 bees in the summer in a hive, and that reduces to about 10,000 in the winter. The hive is basically made up of one queen who can typically live between 1 and 5 years or more in some circumstances, but generally it's usually 2 or 3, and she can lay 1,000 to 2,000 eggs a day.
Wow, that's amazing.
So that's how quickly they can, you know, grow in the summer. And it's her pheromones that let the worker bees, it's her smell that lets the bees know that she's there and that she's healthy. And if those pheromones weaken, for example, if she gets older, the workers sense that, and then they decide if they need to replace it or not. So the workers are also female, but they can't lay fertilised eggs. So a laying queen is essential to the survival of the hive. And mm-hmm. in summer, the female workers will live about 6 weeks as they're working really hard, bringing in the pollen, nectar and water and so on to the hive to feed the larvae. And in the winter, those female bees can actually last 6 months, and it's key those winter bees are healthy to get them through the winter. The male drone bees make up about 20% of the hive, and they are active during the mating season. The queen lays the drone brood in Scotland from about the end of March to the start of April and throughout the summer, and then they will either die from mating with the queen, or mm-hmm. they get chucked out of the hive in autumn by the workers.
That's tough.
It's really tough for the boys, and they're terribly cute as well. They're very big with huge eyes, so they can see the queen, and they get looked after by the workers. But when it's coming in autumn, they're not needed anymore, and the workers cannot sustain their food. They couldn't keep feeding these drones for no reason. So they do get a bit of a hard time, the drones. They get kicked out of the hive to die. And the queen will also stop laying drones as the season moves on as well. So that in the winter, there's no drones at all. They also don't have a sting. That's why I always say that the drones are really useful, but they're also very cute because you can pick them up without fear.
And without being stung?
Yeah.
I had no idea. Can I just ask, yeah. I was always led to believe that if there's a honeybee very, very tired, to give them honey on a teaspoon, you're probably aghast at that in terms of disease and things. But are those bees the drones, or the workers, wouldn't they?
They'd be the tired workers. It's mostly the workers that you see out. It would be okay to give them sugar water, but yeah. not honey, because it might have disease spores in it, and that would just be passing that on.
Wow.
Especially
if you're, really good point.
You know, you've got honey from a source that you're not aware of.
Yes.
So yeah, sugar water is the way to go there, and it'll be the female workers that you will see out and about on the flowers. They're pretty incredible creatures, actually, because like I mentioned before, the queen, it's not the queen who decides things, it's
yes.
the worker bees.
Yeah.
They'll decide if they want to dispatch her or not and make a new queen.
So, that's incredible. So the workers only live for, do you say 6 weeks?
6 weeks in the summer, because they work so hard. And 6 months in the winter because they're not working so hard.
6 months in the winter.
Yeah. And they basically make sure the queen stays fed and watered and looked after.
And the drones have no sting.
The drones get looked after as well.
The drones get looked after, but get chucked out when they're no longer needed.
And they're eaten.
So, do honeybees actually hibernate in the winter?
No, they don't. What they do is they cluster close to the queen, so they keep the temperature regular in the hive. So it doesn't matter how cold or how hot it gets outside, the inside of the hive is the same temperature, and when it gets colder they cluster tighter together, a bit like, can you imagine humans hugging to keep warm?
Yeah.
So the bees will cluster around the queen and keep her warm like that, and when the weather improves the cluster will break and they'll move further out. And in the winter, worker bees, when the temperature goes up a little bit and there's pollen and water sources, they will go out to forage on those pollen sources to keep the larvae fed throughout the winter. And they will also go out to evacuate their guts and keep the hive clean. So they go out for the toilet. So that inside the hives all kept nice and clean, and they regulate the temperature in the hive. They're really quite incredibly clever creatures.
It's amazing how they all work together as one big society.
Yeah.
I think man could learn a lot from the honeybee, apart from them chucking out the bees that are no longer useful. That's really fascinating. So, Lorraine, why is it important to know the difference between the honeybees and any other bees that we have?
That's a really good question, because people do tend to think of, when they think of bees, they actually think of bumblebees.
Mm, yeah.
You know, the big, stocky, cute bees. And actually, honeybees are very different. They're much smaller. Scotland has approximately 23 species of bumblebees and 79 species of solitary bees. Neither of those live in a hive. Some of the bees are endangered because of lack of forage, or, you know, the fact that, you know, we don't have fields and fields of meadows and bushes and trees like we used to. It's important to know the difference, because bumblebees will nest in places like bird boxes, in the soffits of roofs, mm-hmm. in compost heaps and underground. Mm-hmm. And quite often, beekeepers will get a call to say, oh, we've got bees, can you come and collect them? And unfortunately, if they're bumblebees, we can't. You know, the Bumblebee Conservation Trust may be able to advise in that case. Yeah. But for us, you know, we can't go and move bumblebees out of someone's house. But bumblebees do not, the queens will hibernate over winter, but they will die out at the sort of autumn time. So what you would want to do there is probably, once they've died out, block up the hole or wherever they were, and then you might not get them back the next year. Also, honeybees are the only ones to store nectar and turn it into honey. So, for example, if you did have honeybees in your roof or your wall or your chimney.
Yeah, I've had that. They're very good bees.
And for a lot of people, they don't mind. But if it started, the honey starts seeping through the walls or dripping down, that can be a bit of a problem. So, you know, that's when you would call someone to maybe come out, and you might actually need specialists to do that because it is quite messy and quite complicated. But you know, you can help the bumblebees and the solitary bees in lots of different ways as well. You've probably seen the bee hotels. The solitary bees love those, and those little holes that some new builds have got with holes in the bricks.
Yes, lots more gardens have them now, don't they? They seem to be garden centres selling them and people making them.
Yeah, they do. And yeah, that just that sort of thing will help those. But to know the difference is useful if you have an issue with bees in your garden or your house or whatever. If you get a swarm in your garden, that's quite an interesting thing to happen and to see. But I'm also here to advise on how to do that.
Yes, well I was going to say, how can you tell if you've actually got a swarm? And what should you do if anyone's got a swarm?
So swarms usually happen sort of late April to early September.
Right.
And it will depend on the weather as well. They usually form in a large sort of teardrop shape. And when they swarm initially, they will usually go somewhere not far from the hive, fairly accessible. And then the clever bit comes where they send out scout bees looking for a new home. And they come back and they then, in a sort of democratic way, convince the rest of the swarm which is the best home to go to. But usually once they're in that teardrop shape, that's when they're easily accessible, easy to catch, before they decide to find a new home up in a tree or in a chimney, or if you're a beekeeper, they might have a swarm box waiting for them, a ready-made home waiting for them to go into. They're at their least aggressive when they're swarming, so don't be afraid, because they've got no honey stores to defend. But you really should know, if you're just a regular everyday person, don't try to collect them. Don't go too near them, because although they're at their most calmest, they still will sting you if you harass them.
Yeah.
And the best thing you can do there is to, most local beekeeping associations have a swarm collectors list, and there's a list of the different associations on the South of Scotland Beekeepers website. Or quite often, if people just put these days on Facebook, anybody know a beekeeper?
There's usually someone who knows someone, isn't there?
Someone, yeah. The only thing I would say is give a clear description of what it looks like, because mm-hmm. I have been called out to Cotoneasta bushes, ivy bushes, and it's just been bees enjoying the food.
Oh, I see. Well, that's interesting.
But you know, if they're in this sort of teardrop ball shape hanging somewhere, then take a picture if you can, or a video, or you know, give a really good description, and that will help the beekeeper know what equipment they need. Unfortunately, if it's in a building or high up out of reach, you might need somebody a bit more specialist, especially if it involves building work. But most beekeeping associations will find you someone to come and collect that swarm. The more complex ones, you might need a specialist bee removal firm. And you can find these on the internet, or ask for advice from me, or the Scottish Beekeepers Association. They'll put you in touch with someone who may be able to help.
That's useful advice, Lorraine. So, I mean, is it true that honeybees are a threat to other bees?
This has been something that has come up as an issue in the last few years. And there is concern, for example, in places like London, where there's not huge amounts of forage, but there's lots of, it became very popular, especially during COVID, for people to put beehives on the top of buildings. And there's little evidence to suggest that honeybees are a threat to other bees, but there is a concern in places where there's poor forage, that they might be, I suppose, overtaking the native bumblebees and solitary bees for feeding on nectar and pollen.
Oh, that's an important point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe people don't think about that.
Yeah, so it's not like, we're not encouraging people to go out and get bees to save the bees. There's better ways of doing that. And in areas where there's a great deal of competition for forage, for bees looking for food, that might be the case. However, various kind of bees can actually forage on different plants and they can get along absolutely fine in most places. The other place where it might be a little bit of an issue is in very remote places where there's not a great deal of plants and trees and bushes, for all of the bees to get enough food. So it's about being a responsible beekeeper, really. You don't want to be going and putting 20 hives in one place where there's lots of bees already, or in a remote place where there's it's not been that successful, and there's not enough food for them. So really what's important for saving the bees and saving all of the bees, bumblebees and solitary bees and honeybees, is basically to plant for pollinators, restore wildflower meadows, plant various trees and bushes, to help the bees have enough food, really. Because we depend on them for food as well. We depend on all kinds of bees for food, for pollinating our fruit and veg, for pollinating our flowers, our oilseed rape, that sort of thing. So, they are all equally important in my mind, and the best way we can help all pollinators is to feed them the best we can and plant more. The only thing that will impact on all pollinators is the yellow-legged hornet, which is in the south of England and will likely move its way up north, at some point. It predates on bees but also other pollinators, and again, we want to make sure that all pollinators have enough food and are protected. And we'll discuss the yellow-legged hornet in more detail in a future podcast.
Yeah, no, I
Basically,
look forward to hearing about that because there's been an awful lot of information on the news, hasn't there,
yeah,
where people are trying to track them.
and recently it being found in Wales and in Ireland.
They're moving up. Yeah, they're moving up. So Lorraine, I mean, we've obviously you've touched on how we can help bees and the fact that they're so important as our pollinators, just so that we have food. I mean, that's how important they are. Without them, we don't get food. I mean, do you have any top tips on how we can help bees? I mean, I know you've kind of covered it, but I mean, is there anything in terms of prioritizing what we can do?
The best way you can help bees is not just to plant things yourself, but also get your community involved. There are so many projects in Scotland, that help pollinators. I know that there's one along the Tweed. And in Ayrshire, they've got some wildflower sites, and all over Scotland, you can find these groups and communities trying to make a difference. If you're on your own, you can make a difference by having, a few planters full of herbs. Bees love herbs and various different plants. so that the bees can have food all year round. We don't often think about the bees going out for food in the winter, but things like snowdrops and crocuses at this time of year, they'll get good pollen sources from that. And in sort of late autumn, heather and ivy is a good source of food for the bees. And in summer, all sorts of plants, herbs, blackberries, trees are also really good. Things like willow and sycamores, fields of clover, which we don't see so much these days. And, you know, you can do a bit of research. It's really quite fascinating, all the different plants that the different bees like. Because some plants, honeybees, can't actually get into the nectar. Because they're
For the way their mouth parts are, the length of their mouth parts.
Yeah, and other bees have got longer tongues to reach into certain plants, and some bees will actually cheat and pierce where the nectar is. They're so incredible, and you know, you can make solitary bee homes at home. You can leave dishes of water and stones because they need water as well. And they need pollen and they need nectar. We don't often have it in Scotland, but we did last year. We had what's called a June gap, and it almost went into July, where the weather was so unpredictable that sometimes there's a couple of weeks where we have to really watch that the bees have got enough food, because there's nothing yielding nectar or pollen. But you know, all of those plants, Cotoneaster, blackberry, trees like willow and sycamore are also really good, especially in spring. The bees love trees in the spring, and it often makes a really nice dark honey, whereas in the summer they're on a wide variety, and you know, the honey's a bit lighter, a bit sweeter in the summer. And then you've got heather honey and oilseed rape honey. So a lot of farmers actually have fields of oilseed rape, and having honeybees on the land can actually increase their yields quite dramatically.
Wow, Lorraine, that's fascinating. And I hadn't really thought about that. I've learned so much from what you've been talking about today. So for the benefit of our listeners, how can our listeners find out more about the honeybees? We can put things on notes, so I can put links to various places on the notes for this podcast. But are there any pointers?
There's lots of things you can do apart from planting. Obviously, you can join a local beekeeping association, or there are various other pollinator groups like the Bumblebee Conservation Trust. I can actually advise on pollinators for things like any crofters, farmers or smallholders, and beekeepers can get in touch with me to get advice. Or we're holding two pollinator conferences through the Farm Advisory Service this year. One at the Barney in Dumfries on the 27th of February, and one in Perth on the 27th of March. So if you were interested in those, just get in touch with me. I'll also give you some links to put in the notes where you can find out more about all the different kinds of bees and so on.
That's great, Lorraine. Thank you very much for that. I think that's been a really fascinating insight and a really good introduction on honeybees. And I look forward to having you again. And what we'll try and do for our listeners is have some regular slots throughout the year. So do follow us, do sign up for our podcast. I know it's called On the Hoof because we normally talk about all sorts of things for hoofed animals. But bees really are special, and they cross all of our lives, and they are vitally important. So thank you, Lorraine. And I look forward to speaking with you again soon. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you.